In 2018, a migrant family from central Queensland were taken from their home and flown across the country.
The two children being dragged and dragged by our government to various different places. Just let this family stay here. We beg our government.
The treatment of this family at the hands of the government has highlighted the problems in Australia's immigration processes, described by some as deliberately cruel.
It's cruel, it's un-Australian, and they should be brought back here immediately.
Their story has split politicians across the spectrum.
They didn't come to the country in the appropriate way. They have not been found to have an asylum claim. And to have changed our policy on this or to exercise intervention powers on this would be to send exactly the wrong message.
It is, without question, one of those examples where common sense and compassion would say, let's just let this family stay.
Now, their last chance to stay in the country is being assessed by a court in Melbourne this Friday.
A federal court hearing next week will be their final chance to convince a judge they're genuine refugees and should be allowed to return to their home in Bilawila in central Queensland.
I think in positive, my court case is good decision. All Australians support, good love. I thank you so much, all of you.
Today, what's going to happen to the Bilawila family? I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story.
I was on Christmas Island covering the coronavirus outbreak. That's where Australians who were in Wuhan in China had been evacuated to.
Ben Doherty is a reporter for Guardian Australia.
But while I was there, I found time to go to, there's a recreation centre, there's a cricket ground, a basketball court, swimming pool, that sort of stuff, right in the middle of the island, right on top of the hill. And there I was able to talk to a family. This is a family from Sri Lanka who are currently detained on Christmas Island. A couple of times a week, they get bussed from the detention centre, which is right on the other side of the island, to this recreation centre. They do a bit of heavily guarded, I suppose, exercise.
So who is this family?
There's Priya and Nardis, and they have two children, Kopika, who's four, and Tarunika, she's two. Nardis is very reserved. He doesn't speak readily. He's quite shy. Priya is a little more outgoing, a little more confident with her English. The girls are very friendly and very bubbly. When I met them in the recreation hall, Nardis was sort of sitting quietly by himself. Priya walks laps, lap after lap of the basketball court. Kopika was riding a little bike around the court and Tarunika was throwing a ball to her mother. They have a degree of freedom while they're there, and I just walked up and introduced myself and we began talking. They talked to a number of people. They've made some friends on the island through their limited chance to get outside, and we just had a discussion about what their lives are like. We talked about life in the detention centre, essentially, and what's going to happen in their future. The detention centre where they spend almost all of their time is absolutely enormous. It's huge. It would take maybe an hour, hour and a half to walk all the way around. It's heavily guarded, very high steel electrified fences. The whole family of four, they sleep in one room, in one bed, in fact. And it's designed to accommodate, you know, more than 1,000 asylum seekers.
And how many people have been detained there since it was reactivated?
I currently have four people.
But before the coronavirus evacuees, they were the only four people in there. This entire centre was run for four people.
Since the reactivation, have there ever been any other detainees there?
No, Senator.
No. So we spent in the region of $30 million to detain four people for a couple of months. Is that right?
Yep.
109 staff and the government spent over several months, about $28 million to keep them locked up in that place. I think they might be the loneliest asylum seekers in the country.
Okay, so Ben, let's go back a bit. What has this family been through? How did they get here?
Both Nardis and Priya are from the Tamil ethnic minority in Sri Lanka. This is an ethnic minority that has faced extreme persecution in Sri Lanka over recent decades, including as the focus of part of it, a 26-year civil war. Nardis arrived in Australia in 2012 and Priya arrived a year later in 2013, both of them coming by boat. They met in Australia and they fell in love, they married, and they moved to Bilawila, a town in central Queensland.
And what was their life like in Bulawila?
By all accounts, and they have a great many friends in the town, very, very successful. They've started a family there. Both their daughters were born in Bulawila, Kopika in 2015 and Tarunaka in 2017. Nardis had a job at the local meatworks. Priya was a volunteer around the town. Their daughters were in daycare and about to start school. This is something the government is pushing for refugees and new migrants in this country to go to regional areas to where there's work, where there are houses, to sort of populate these towns. And Nardis and Priya did this. And they
did everything the government asked of refugees or immigrants.
Nardis began work. Priya became this sort of integral cog in the Bulawila community, and the girls were much loved, and they seemed to be building a life together.
I got to know them through a Sri Lankan family living behind me. They first used to walk past and give a little wave, but not really brave enough to give the full wave. And they learned quickly that our hearts in this town were open to welcome them.
So they made their life there in Bulawila, but how was everything going from a legal perspective?
Yeah, so the family were living in Bulawila completely legally. They had bridging visas while their case was being assessed, and while they were before the appeals tribunal and before the court. So they had bridging visas. The bridging visa has work rights attached, so Nardis was working legally and paying tax. They were legitimate, legal members of the Australian community the whole time.
Nadas, he worked really hard at the meatworks, and they work hard at the meatworks, and he contributed to our town, which we desperately need. Priya, she was a volunteer at our local Vinnie's. Then they had their little children, and their little children used to come into the centre, which we have, Woolworths Centre, and everybody would wave to them, and they would wave. They spoke to us, they called us Grandma, they were our friends.
So they lived in Bulawila for 4 years. Where it starts to unravel is March 2018, when Priya's bridging visa expired at midnight on the 4th of March in 2018. Now, it's not unusual for people who are living on bridging visas for those to expire, and there's sometimes a lag before the new one comes through. Priya had been in discussion with her sort of case manager, her officer in the government department, for a new visa to be sent. And then at 5 a.m. on the 5th of March, so 5 hours after Priya's bridging visa expired, Border Force officials, accompanied by police and security guards, come knocking on the door. The family say they were given 10 minutes to pack. They were separated from each other and driven to Gladstone Airport and flown directly to Melbourne, where they were taken straight into detention. This was hugely terrifying. They didn't know what was going on, where they were going to end up, what was happening. And as the community in Bulawila found out what was happening to this family, that's when you start to see them really rally around this family.
We've travelled down last night from Bulawila in central Queensland to come here today to deliver this petition with over a quarter of a million signatures to Scott Morrison to ask him, as we have asked right from the start, to let our friends come home to Bulawila.
Supporters of a Tamil family facing deportation have also rallied in Melbourne.
Let them stay.
This is it. Thousands of Tamils across the country have come to show their support for this beautiful family from Bulawila. We cannot deport them to danger. Deporting them to danger essentially puts their...
Is there any indication why the government felt it necessary to conduct this dawn raid and whisk them out of their homes in regional Queensland to a detention centre in Melbourne?
The government contests the way that's been reported, but all the evidence is that that's exactly how it happened, that it was a lot of Border Force officers coming very aggressively at 5 o'clock in the morning. The reasons have never been explained, but this is something that happens. It is a known, if not a policy, certainly a known practice to take refugees and asylum seekers from places where they have connection, where they have family connections or community connections, and move them somewhere else. All the time, asylum seekers are sort of crisscrossing the country, forcibly moved from one detention centre to another. And it was not an accident that they were taken 2,000 kilometres away. It was quite deliberate.
So what did the family do once they got to the Melbourne Detention Centre?
initially they were asked to sign documents saying they agreed to leave Australia and to go back to Sri Lanka. They initially refused, but finally, after a couple of after a day or two, they agreed to sign these papers, but they say they were coerced, and that they say that they never, you know, genuinely consented to leaving. So, I think
Is their English good enough to be able to read legal documents and to give informed consent?
Priya's English is okay, but I think certainly not to that degree. They didn't have access to friends or community members. You know, they didn't have you know, a lawyer to speak to. I think you also need to kind of imagine what that's like to have been sort of dragged from your home that you've lived in for 4 years and flown to another part of the country in detention and told you need to sign this document in a language that's not your first, under sort of extreme pressure. That doesn't strike me as a terribly democratic or fair process.
What was their experience in the Melbourne Detention Centre like?
Detention, and I've been to the detention centre in Melbourne, it's a pretty oppressive place, and this family, I think, suffered more than most. They were there for more than a year, and beyond the sort of simple fact of detention and the constricted life you have and the fact that you're behind wire all the time and you're monitored wherever you go, it's the sort of small cruelties, I think, that people that they found really injurious. Tarunika had a toothache and it took months for her to get any dental, and she was in enormous pain for her to get any sort of dental treatment. For even minor injuries, it took, you know, filling out of forms and waiting and days and weeks and these sorts of things. So their sort of general health and general condition deteriorated. The little girls both had birthdays. The family asked if friends could bring a birthday cake to them, and that was rejected. They weren't allowed a birthday cake for the girls' birthdays. The girls made friends with some other families in detention, and then they were excluded from seeing them, so they weren't allowed to see their friends. Just the It's the tiny oppressions beyond the sort of broader sweep of the way these people were treated that was particularly harmful. And I think when you think about young children's development and young children growing up, hugely damaging.
And what happened next?
There's a lot of legal back and forth, and it becomes very complicated very quickly. Essentially, in March of 2018, the family is taken to Melbourne. 3 months later, in June, the federal court rejects the family's appeal against deportation. Just under a year later, in May of 2019, the family loses its bid to have the High Court hear the case. And a few months after that, they were put on a plane to take them to Sri Lanka.
Welcome back to The Project. For nearly 18 months, we've been following the story of Tamil asylum seekers Priya and Nadez and their two Australian boys.
The flight was extremely traumatic. The family's forcibly taken on board this plane.
And this is exactly what deportation looks like.
Me, separate bed. My wife, separate bed.
The children are crying. They're screaming for their parents.
My baby crying. My.
And they're terrified about what's happening.
My, hold me. My hand, no, painful. No.
Just relax.
My hand, painful.
Just relax.
My hand's not painful.
Just relax.
Yeah.
Don't worry. It's going to be fine.
Priya says she's injured as this happens. People around the country are watching this flight. There are protests at the airport trying to stop it leaving, and they were in the air when lawyers for the family went to the court and sought an injunction, an urgent injunction, as this family were in the air flying west towards Colombo.
That's right, Peter. They did get an injunction order last night, which means that they aren't allowed to be deported from Australia until at least 12 noon today now.
The plane landed in Darwin and they were taken off the plane.
So someone from the court got in touch with the pilot and told them to land.
That's exactly, I mean, this is the very definition of last minute. These people were almost out of Australian jurisdiction but were still able to be reached and the plane brought to land in Darwin so the family could be unloaded and the plane goes on without them.
Next, the little girl at the centre of the injunction. So the family's lawyers seek this emergency injunction. It's granted, and that means the plane was forced to land so they can't be deported. What was the basis of this injunction?
Migration law is complicated, but essentially this is all based on the youngest daughter, Tarunika.
4 p.m. on the 4th of September. Has that stopped their removal, though, or technically the two-year-old?
No, really, at this stage, the injunction just covers the two-year-old child, and obviously it will be left to the department and the minister to determine what to do with the remaining members of the family.
Everyone else in the family has had their refugee application assessed by the government and denied.
Yeah, so that's the fundamental argument that we're running in the federal court at the minute, is that the child, the youngest child, was never part of the applications to the High Court or any applications that have previously been run, and it's our view that that child needs their claims to be considered independently.
But Tarunika, who was born in Bilawila, remember, she's 2 years old and has never been to Sri Lanka, has never left Australia. Her right to be in Australia, her right to claim protection here, has never been assessed.
How significant is that?
Well, I mean, given even the sheer amount of media attention this case has had, not including just today, but in the past, you would have to argue that this is an unusual case which warrants the minister's attention.
What makes it unusual?
Well, probably the media, the length of time that it's been running for, that the child also has claims on her own. She is a young female.
And so was she assessed?
Well, not yet. What's happened next is the family was taken from Darwin and transferred to Christmas Island, and that's where they've been waiting for that assessment to take place. From August of last year to now, they've just been waiting in detention.
So you're happy with the way this has been handled?
I would like the family to accept that they are not refugees, that they're not owed protection by our country. They came here by boat, and we've been very clear that they wouldn't stay. At the same time, we've been very compassionate about the number of people that we've brought in, including many families. But in this case, they've been found right to the High Court not to be refugees. There are something like 68 million people in the world who are not refugees.
Okay, so this case revolves around Tarunika's refugee claim. You said the rest of the family had their claims denied.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Essentially, the government said that they would not face persecution if they were returned to Sri Lanka, and Australia therefore doesn't owe them an obligation, a protection obligation. Priya left Sri Lanka in 2000 and fled to southern India with her family. She's never been back to Sri Lanka since, and her family faced some extreme persecution, including seeing family members set alight. And this is at the height of what was a very, very brutal civil war between the Sri Lankan military and the separatist army, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, usually known as the Tamil Tigers.
Why didn't Priya stay in India?
India doesn't formally recognise refugee status, and Tamils who flee there live life on the margins. It's very difficult to access healthcare or education, and there's a great deal of pressure upon Tamils to go back to Sri Lanka, essentially. Life is very difficult. Nardis had links with the Tamil Tigers, and it needs to be remembered that during the height of the Civil War, most men of fighting age had some sort of link with the Tamil Tigers, and this can be anything from the Tigers turning up demanding to use your house or to borrow your boat or to take fuel or for food. All of that can be interpreted as being associated with the Tigers, and that can be enough for you to face persecution.
So the Australian government found that Nardes had a link to the Tamil Tigers.
That was Nardes's claim. In response to that, the argument is that the war has ended, there is relative peace in Sri Lanka now, and that Tamils and those with links to the Tigers don't face persecution anymore. There is a lot of evidence that that's not the case. We've had UN rapporteurs go to Sri Lanka. There are still thousands of people missing from the end of the civil war. Tamil Tigers still face extreme persecution, the militarisation and the seizure of land in the north of the country. And to pretend that all is well now that the war is over is simply not correct.
But if the government has gone through the process of assessing their applications and found them not to be in need of protection, then isn't that fair?
That certainly is the government's argument, that both Priya and Nardis and Kopika was attached to their, the eldest daughter was attached to their claim, have been through a process and have been found not to to require Australia's protection. They went through what's called the fast track process. Now, this is very controversial. It was introduced to deal with a great many asylum claims. And it's basically a process where you get one chance to lay out your claim for refugee protection before the Australian government. Any subsequent information you're able to present, any changes in circumstance, so anything you forgot or weren't able to talk about or weren't able to make clear the first time you gave an interview, none of that can be taken into account. And so all of the subsequent hearings in tribunals, in courts, were not assessments of their refugee claim, but just assessments to see that the process had been followed. Now, the process was followed, but the argument is the process was flawed. In the case of Priya, she was 8 months pregnant at the time that she gave her interview. She was in Bilawila, talking on the phone, a three-way phone hookup with an interpreter and somebody in Canberra.
You don't get to go to court. You just speak to an official
over
the phone.
Over the phone.
And there's a third person interpreting for her.
A third person interpreting.
So this is a three-way phone call.
She was 8 months pregnant at the time and been hospitalised with a migraine the day before. It's obviously a very stressful situation. And lots of the evidence we've seen from the transcript of her interview shows that the phone line dropped out consistently and they had to ring people back. There were allegations and discussions around torture that weren't heard by people to the phone call. So there is a great deal of concern amongst supporters of this family that their claim for protection was never genuinely and properly assessed.
Can you tell us a little bit about the situation in Sri Lanka today? So if they were returned next week or the week after, what situation would they be facing?
Asylum seekers who return to Sri Lanka, the first thing they do is go to court. You land at Negombo, where the airport is, and you're taken to the local court, and then the initial charge you face is leaving the country illegally. A lot of people find it then very difficult, I suppose, to escape the criminal justice system. They find themselves being monitored wherever they go. They find themselves being called into the police for lots of reasons, just to answer questions, where have you been, who are you talking with? They will lead their lives under a significant suspicion. It has been such a long time for this family. Priya hasn't been there in 2 decades. The girls know nothing of Sri Lanka. They've never been. It's very difficult to see how this family finds a new life back in Sri Lanka, a place they have very little connection to anymore, and how they sort of rebuild from here, particularly after 2 years of languishing in detention in the Australian system.
The matter regarding the Tamil family is a very sensitive one. I've been active in this area of policy for a very long period of time. The most compassionate thing you can always do is just make sure your borders are strong. No one is surprised by the decisions we've taken on this, because it's born of experience, it's born of the success of our policies.
Are there any other avenues that would allow the family to stay in Australia?
There are. The immigration minister has the right to intervene and to personally allow this family to stay. In this area of law, the immigration minister is extraordinarily powerful and has the power to unilaterally say this family can stay.
Section 195A of the Migration Act provides for powers of intervention, very broad powers, by the minister, who must arbitrate on a whole range of issues. And those powers wouldn't exist were it not for the fact that there is a view that in some instances the minister must intervene.
The decision that has been made that the parents were not qualified as asylum seekers, but that's the parents, not the children. And time has moved on, and there's, you know, like the policeman, constabulary right, ministerial discretion. At times I think this should be exercised to basically bring a situation to a conclusion. These children were born in Australia, they are not their parents, and I think we have to consider it in a different light.
We've seen this power used very, very often.
He intervened last year in relation to nannies, for God's sake. And the argument being, oh, well, the nannies were to be deported, but they were really needed by a family who was financially well off but couldn't really survive without nannies.
You might remember Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton used the power to allow two au pairs to stay in the country in 2018.
I mean, those intervention powers exist. They have been used to say, oh, this will open the floodgates, is an absolutely nonsense argument.
But in September last year, Prime Minister Scott Morrison ruled out ministerial intervention in this family's case.
And the family, when they return, should that be the decision of the courts, to Sri Lanka, then they are very welcome to make an application to come to Australia the same way that everyone else does. There'll be no special favours or special treatment. Why should there be? There are thousands, there are hundreds of thousands of people who want to come and make their life here in Australia.
Why is the government treating this family, who had ostensibly done everything the government asks of immigrants to do, in work, paying taxes, living in the community, two Australian daughters, why are they being treated like this?
I think that's goes a long way to explaining the level of public outrage about this and why this is being so keenly felt in Australia. This is a family who'd, as you say, done everything that the government had asked and expected of immigrants. I think the government is unhappy at being challenged in this way, I suppose, and this family is choosing to exercise its legal rights. I think the government's made a rod for its own back by its inflexibility, its inability to sort of say, we need to consider people's lives and the impact on children, and its sort of rigid adherence to sort of prosecuting its laws to the full extent without making concessions for the situation of this family has made it very difficult for the government to go anywhere else.
What's next for this family?
Well, Tarunaka's court case is going before the court this Friday in Melbourne. The family won't be there. They'll be on Christmas Island still. We will find out when the court makes its judgment whether this family is allowed to return to their home in Bilawila, to their community in Bilawila, or whether they'll be deported back to Sri Lanka. This is essentially their last roll of the dice.
And if Tarunaka's case is successful and she is found to have a right to live in Australia, does the whole family get to stay?
There is a principle in international law and domestic law around the unity of the family, that families are to be kept together and not split up unnecessarily. It would be an extreme case to see a two-year-old removed from their family and everybody else deported while she stays in Australia. So the answer is that, yes, the family would be able to stay if Tarunaka's claim is successful.
What happens if the case is unsuccessful?
If that doesn't succeed, I think there's a very strong case for the minister to intervene and allow this family to stay, this family that's been a model migrant family to Australia, if ever there was a case for the exercise of these ministerial powers. This family is the case. But the government has spent so much money and has been so firm and so inflexible about this. The government has backed itself into a corner on this case, saying this family won't be allowed to stay, that I don't see a way that this government is going to intervene to allow this family to stay in Australia.
The Bilawila family will be in court this Friday, the 21st of February. If you want to keep up to date with what's happening, visit theguardian.com. We'll be covering the story. This episode of Full Story was produced by Ellen Leibeater and Joe Koning. Our executive producer is Miles Martignoni. I'm Gabrielle Jackson, filling in for Laura Murphy-Oates while she's on holiday. Thanks for listening. If you're on an app that has ratings or reviews, we'd love to hear from you. That's it for today. See you Friday.